You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh.
My guest today is actor and writer Finn Wittrock. Finn is an actor who I've admired for a long time. He was in the class ahead of me at Juilliard, and we did some outreach work there together. Actually, with both of our future spouses, my husband, Frankie, and his now wife, Sarah, who was in the dance division at Juilliard, we all did an outreach trip to New Orleans years ago. Finn has done a really wide variety of acting work in his career, and I was excited to get his perspective for the podcast. He's based in LA, so this was recorded over FaceTime. I hope you enjoy the 129th episode of The Compass.
Writing for me has always been a thing that has kept me able to feel creative in times when acting is not giving me the love that I want it to be. Mm-hmm. When because as an actor, there are so many people that have to say yes to you, and there is so much there's such an infrastructure that has to kind of open up for you to be able to do your art, and writing and writing plays, writing poems, writing screenplays has been a thing that I've been able to kind of maintain some kind of my own creativity without having to rely on other people, you know.
Yeah.
Although to make a movie happen, to make a play happen, you still need to have other people come around, but you can still kind of keep the spark going inside yourself.
Yeah, the initial action you can do on your own.
Yes, exactly. And it's also been, you know, it's been important to, like, have a home that feels safe and good and something that also feeds your creativity, you know? Like, going out to a new crazy restaurant or going to see great films with someone that you love. I mean, that's a really, it is an important thing, you know? And I think without a kind of long-term relationship, I might feel I have a tendency to be very isolated and alone, and so that's a thing that's always kind of kept me stable, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And now you have Zeke, so...
But now I have Zeke.
You're all set.
Zeke, it's really true. I mean, having a dog really does... It's good, first of all, because it makes you think about something outside yourself.
Yeah.
And also, they just... always love you. It doesn't matter what you do or what kind of bastard you've been all day. I mean, they'll always greet you with the same enthusiasm. It changes your life, really. It really does. Now, like the other night, we were at some fancy award show thing, and I dropped him off at my mom's house because we were going to be away for so long, and we came home, and it was so quiet in the house. Like, it's just the two of us here? What are we going to do? There's no one barking or running around. It's so lonely.
Yeah. No, it really is
they do
true.
They really do add an incredible life to your house.
Yeah, and to have something that no matter what, like, they don't care about whatever existential path you're going down. They need to be fed. No. They need to be walked.
Yeah. And that's good. And, you know, and that's the thing. I think at first people are like, oh, God, can I deal with that? Can I handle the walking and the petting and... But that becomes the joy, you know?
I was going to say, it's the petting.
I got to go home.
The petting is definitely one step too far.
Very important.
So what sort of writing is really intriguing you these days? What form does that take that you find really therapeutic?
Well, therapeutic and productive are two different things.
Either.
I have been writing screenplays. I have there's a movie I wrote with a friend called The Submarine Kid, which we filmed a few years ago.
With Dylan, right?
Shoestring budget. Yeah. And a lot of friends. We kind of pulled all the friendships we could to help us out.
Mm-hmm.
And I have this horror movie that I've written that is getting a bit of traction, I think. But I wouldn't say that's therapeutic per se. I mean, that's like now becoming a part of the career. And it is fun and exciting, but it's also work, you know?
Right.
To me, like the thing that's always been the writing thing that's been the therapeutic part is poetry. I think that in some other life where people actually made money off of being poets, I do that very happily and never do anything else. But that's still the kind of part of my, that's something that's kept me, kept some part of my brain alive since before Juilliard. I was like kind of writing pretty actively, and now that I'm writing like more practical things, uh-huh. I do that less, but I try to kind of keep it in practice in some degree.
So what does the dark side look like for you most often? Like when I say that, what does it mean for you in your artistic life?
You know, it changes. I mean, I've been lucky in a lot of ways. I've been able to work pretty consistently, but like when I was first starting out, it was just the complete shock of rejection. Which, like, you know, I mean, coming out of Juilliard, they kind of make it feel like the world is going to open up to you and be a wonderful open door and red carpets and great directors everywhere you go. You know, I felt at least our class, I'm sure it's still the same, you feel like you're on top of the universe when actually you're just beginning to be at the bottom of a large, very large pile that you, like, crawl up for the rest of your life. I mean that in the best way.
Well, it's such a small, like, you're coming out of such initial, a small pool.
Yes.
Yeah.
And but there is a build-up to it, you know, like, you're like, the end of your fourth year, you're just like, oh man, the world's going to open to me in some huge way. And then when it doesn't, I think it can be a real... it can be a real ego hit. And I think a lot of people, myself included, like, really were shocked by it. I was lucky because I took this year off between high school and college, and I actually turned Juilliard down. Weird, like, I have some 18-year-old hubris, and I and I tried to audition in L.A., and I, like, got a couple guest stars on ER and stuff, but I also worked at a frozen yogurt place, and I did a couple other random day jobs and kind of learned what it was not to work and to be rejected. So when Juilliard happened, I at least had some kind of, you know, scar tissue there that I could fall back on that prepared me a bit for the real hard rejection of, like, even like I remember like being for something that now I would never, like, some CW thing that I was like, it was like this recurring part on 90210 that I was thinking I was going to get, and I was like, couldn't pay my rent, and I was still working waiting tables, and was just like dying for this part. They flew me out to LA for a screen test. And during a blizzard, I remember this, and then they flew me back, and I literally, when I got into the hotel in LA, I didn't have enough money. I didn't have a credit card, first of all, and I didn't have enough money, like, in my bank account for the hotel to allow me to stay there, because, you know, you need, right, like a $300,
just
if you're not
in case,
have a credit card, you need like a $300, or like the limit, like, checking account number.
Oh God!
Amount, and I didn't even have that, so I had to, like, I don't know, my mom, I begged, borrowed, and stole to, like, so I think my mom and my dad came in and they put a credit card down for me, although, like, my mom didn't have any money either. anyway, the point is, I didn't get that job, and I was like just dying about it, and then I worked like 6 more months kind of just waiting tables and doing the thing. And I know that sounds like silly. It's like, whatever. I mean, I complain about that to or talk about that to like friends who are doing it now, and it's like, they're like, well, you worked 6 months waiting tables, like, go fuck yourself. But that was the initial darkness, was like, thinking things were going to go a certain way, and then just being kind of rejected at every turn.
Just the volume of auditions you have to go on to eventually get that one thing. It really, like you said, it's like that shock of rejection. It's the volume.
I really think, I still audition, and I still think I don't get 90% of the jobs that I go in for, and that's a good ratio, you know? Like, I'm doing well.
Right.
And, like, that's crazy.
The structure.
There's not many other professions where getting 10% of the things you try out is success.
Yeah.
And there's, I mean, God knows how many auditions I went on in my life, and especially in those early years. Yeah.
So what does it feel like now when you're having one of those periods?
Well, I've been in a funny place the last like 6 months. I've had like this string of kind of really interesting artistic independent films that I was offered the lead of, that all one by one fell through, mostly financially, which is a huge thing that's happening just in the business right now. It's like, it's really hard to make a movie without either studio backing or like Netflix backing or some kind of big thing. It's hard to make like the medium road films nowadays. And this literally happened to me like 4 times in a row, where it was like 2 weeks away from shooting, and then I get a call like, oh, this producer backed out, this financier backed out, oh, the lead we had to do something else, so the movie's pushed back for another 2 years or something.
That close to shooting?
Yeah, very close to shooting.
Wow.
It's crazy. And not just, I mean, like, I complain about it, but I mean, you know, there's location scouts and ADs that they've hired, and the whole pre-production's been like up and working, and then it just gets yanked, the rug gets yanked out from under it.
Right.
And it is a thing, it is a hard thing, it is a thing. I know everyone's like, it's not your fault, but there is, the more you like work in independent film, the more you realize that everybody has like a dollar sign next to their name. Literally, like, if you are trying to pitch a movie, you try to like pitch the financiers to this is your dream cast, and everybody has a number next to them, and that's like based on their international, it's like your international cred, it's
right?
Like what they can sell overseas, which is how they sell everything now, is they sell it to China and everywhere else first. And America's like the last possible place they sell it. And so they can sell your name overseas, which basically means if you've been in a Marvel movie or something of that caliber, then you can get your thing financed. But otherwise, it's really hard, and people...
Even for indies?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
That's
because
crazy.
Because no one's taking any risks anymore, because it's there's so much out there, you know?
Yeah.
It's hard to be like, oh, I should have, why didn't I fuck it? It is my fault, because I could have done something bigger, you know, to get myself, to get this movie financed, you know.
That's so frustrating, especially like how much prep work I'm sure you already did before some of these films that just,
it's like,
goes to waste.
Yeah, you're like working on something and... I believe the technical term is blue balls, you know. you're like really ready to go, and you're like creating a character, and you're doing the thing you've trained to do, and then it just doesn't happen, and like then the script that you've marked up is kind of just like in the recycling bin. It's crazy.
So yeah. Have you started finding any way to deal with that frustration after those projects get canceled?
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I try not to take it out just on the pub next door.
Could it go back to some Carolyn Sirota, like, energy clearing exercise?
Yes. Some good Alexander, free my neck. I'm lucky to have a park. Griffith Park is really close to me, and I take long hikes and try to hash out the world by communing with the hills.
That's always a good way to start.
Yeah. Little nature, yeah.
This is a question I usually ask people, but it's interesting in your case. How does your family take in your choice to be an artist for your career? Because I know, isn't your dad an actor as well, or he used to be?
Yeah. My family has been always been incredibly supportive of me. I was born, and I have a weird kind of funny upbringing. My dad worked at this company called Shakespeare and Company, which was in the Berkshires in Massachusetts, and he was an actor, but and also a voice teacher with Kristen Linklater, and one of her first students in America. And so I kind of grew up when I was young. I would go back every summer to this crazy acting company, and was kind of immersed in it. So it was always part of my life, Shakespeare and the antics of actors were always kind of around me until I was it's funny because I would go back to Evanston in Chicago, outside Chicago, for a very kind of normal public school upbringing, and then every summer would go to this summer Shakespeare company. So I had I was living two lives. And the summer Shakespeare thing was just always a thing that I loved and missed when it was over all year long and couldn't wait to get back there. And so my parents have always been very, very supportive. It's different. I mean, moving into film and television, there are two worlds, theater and film are still kind of separate entities, so they don't totally relate to it all, but they're nothing but very supportive, so I'm very lucky in that way.
Wait, so you grew up in Chicago or in LA then?
So I was born in Massachusetts. I lived there till I was six, and then my dad was I can't make enough money for a family of four.
Right.
Being an actor in this summer Shakespeare company, we're going to Chicago. He started working at DePaul, and DePaul's college in Chicago. And so we moved to Evanston. And then when I was 12, my mom got an offer to get her doctorate, got into the doctorate program at USC as an occupational therapist, which is what she does. She works with babies with autism and stuff. And so we moved here to LA when I was 12.
Gotcha.
But still, until at the end of high school, I would go back to the Berkshires every summer and do Shakespeare and do... run around in the woods of the Berkshires.
That's kind of a wonderful way to grow up.
I'm sorry, so tell me again how old you were when you moved to LA?
I was 12. I was just going into middle school.
So what's it like to live there now as an adult?
It's cool, man. I my teenage years were here. So from 12 till I went to Juilliard, which I was actually 19 when I went.
Right.
I lived here. And then I was in New York, obviously through my 20s until, some jobs I would come back here for a while, but we really moved, it's funny, it's been so bi-coastal, to try to track it is even hard. I moved here for a bit, then moved back to New York, and then moved back here, and then I got Death of a Salesman, and then I stayed there for a while. Literally, it's year to year. But the last 4 years, basically since I got married, we've been pretty steadily here. We've been in this apartment, actually, for the longest time in our whole time together.
That's so nice.
It was totally bi-coastal for a while, but by happenstance, just by the jobs that were happening. And now it's been here for a while. So I moved to LA when I was 12, was there till New York happened, the end of my teenage years, and then, bam, wham, bam.
Do you feel
like the two cities affect you differently as a creative mm-hmm. person?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you know, sorry, I'm not saying like I'm an old man now, but it is funny how LA, it was like I hated LA at first. I was so gung-ho about living in New York and being a New York actor in LA. And New York did treat me well after some initial, rejections. It was when I went back there and like started doing theater, getting theater jobs, it really was amazing. But I do find for my own, for how crazy this business is and how up in the air it is, I do find a sense of solace coming back home to LA. It's not like, I think when most people come here, they have, you know, it's a crazy new place and there's the business and there's fucking Beverly Hills and that whole side of it. But I knew a different side of it. Like I knew it was home, you know, it was where I learned to drive. It was where I went to this arts high school in Cal State LA, it's downtown LA, and it was a county school, so kids lived all over LA County, which is enormous. Like LA County is the size of many small countries, you know. So I would, and I was one of the first of my friends to drive, so I would drive people home. I had a friend who lived in Pomona. I had a friend who lived in Malibu. I had like Burbank, Pasadena, like. If that means anything to anyone listening, like places are very far away from each other. And Castaic, because one girl lived in Castaic, which is, I know it probably means nothing to you, but it's like literally from like Manhattan, it's probably like halfway through New Jersey, like to Pennsylvania. Like it's so fucking far. And so I like, but when I was a high schooler, like that was freedom, like driving someone home. Nowadays, I'd be like, fuck no, I'm not driving to Castaic. But back then, it was like, yes.
Yeah, it's adventure.
2 hours there and back. It's an adventure. Yeah. And so that's what LA was to me, was like this great, crazy, wild adventure. And so that's the kind of sense memory I have of it when I come back to it, is that, you know, that sense of like anything could happen.
That's great. That's a great way to, a great way to be able to approach it.
Yeah. It's different, I think, you know, it's different than most people's, because it's a terrible place to visit. Like, it's a horrible tourist place. Like, New York is, I love to go to New York for 5 days and just see plays and see museums and, like, do all the great stuff. LA is not good, like, it's not a good place to just show up and see what happens, you know.
I feel like I've never been there longer than like 5 days, so I feel like I never get a good grip of it.
It's terrible 5 days.
You need much longer. Is there anything that you've learned about auditioning over the years that you feel like is serving you well now? Like any way that you approach it differently that you feel gives you back some of your power in that type of situation?
Yeah, that's a good question. I come back to this thing that Philip Seymour Hoffman said, which is just like, always be the best actor you can possibly be, like, which is hard, like when you're doing, because most often when you're auditioning, you know that you're not right for this, or you, there are so many things against you, you know, there's a bigger actor probably that's going out for it, or maybe you're not the right size or shape,
or the writing isn't that great, the anyway
sucks, or whatever, you know, there are so many things. But I remember Phil saying this thing of like, just be the best actor you could possibly be in that one moment, and then forget about it, because he's like, it's the being the best actor you can be in the room that is the thing that that carries on, that people talk about. And that's what this business is like, it's about people talking about you. It's all word of mouth, it's all chatting, you know, it's all it's all reputation, you know. And so to create the best reputation every single time you go into a room does add up, even if you don't get that job. And you should, I want to tell like younger people, like, really, you should plan on not getting that job. like that you go in for. You should walk out of that room and you should be like, I did the best audition I could possibly do. I did all the work I could do. I left my blood on the stage there, but that's it. It's over. That's it. I don't need it any more than that. You know, and I think that's the way that you will survive.
That's, it's easier said than done, but it's great advice.
It's way easier said than done, and I wish I could do it all the time, because I definitely don't. I definitely take it with me lots of... Of course, there are some parts that you want and die for and really want and can't stop thinking about, but
right.
If you can try to have that practice of just, like, working your ass off beforehand, doing it, and just leaving it there, I really think that's the way to have longevity.
Yeah.
And that's good, because then you get to really practice your art and not have it be... You're not trying to please someone. You're not trying to do the right thing. You're just like, I'm going to approach this part as if I have it already.
Yeah.
And then when I don't get it, fuck it. I don't need it.
No. That, yeah, it's just, I guess the hard part, at least for me, is like knowing, like you said earlier, like knowing that there's so many people who have to say yes for you to be able to get to do the thing.
Totally.
But not trying to please those people. You know? Because then that's beside the point.
Because pleasing people, when people sense that you're trying to please them, it's not sexy, you know?
Yeah.
Like, people are more interested in someone who comes into the room with their own agenda and their own, who comes in and is like, this is my room for these 2 minutes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Again, easier said than done, of course, but that is the thing that's interesting, you know?
Totally. Do you have any mentors who've been important to you in your artistic career?
You know, it's funny, I just watched this great thing, the PBS Masters thing about Mike Nichols. And I had this, you know, in 2012 I had this really lucky thing where I got cast in Death of a Salesman on Broadway. And Philip Seymour Hoffman and Mike Nichols both became mentors to me in very different ways. Mike was kind of like this grandpa figure, and Phil was like this guy that I just revered and just kind of watched like a hawk and just sort of followed and imitated and like, it was just like hung on his every word.
Hmm.
And they were, and after it was done, they did, like, we did stay in touch, and Mike was really, really, really kind to me. And then they were both dead in like a year. Like, it was like,
oh my God.
Phil died and then Mike died. Like 11 months later or something. So I kind of floundered. Like, I thought this was like, oh my God, I have these two amazing men who are gonna like show me the way. And then they were kind of gone very quickly, and it was it really threw me for a loop. So trying to find someone of that caliber is hard. I'm still looking.
Yeah, you had some lucky introductions there.
Yes. I had a great spurt of awesome mentorship. But they do can kind of continue to inspire me as I kind of watch their work and re-listen to them. And I found this old note that Mike wrote me on our opening night where it was like, just the most beautiful thing in the world to me. And they didn't. I mean, they were mentors for a time. Like, they did inspire me and really changed, I think, kind of changed the actor I was within. It's hard to kind of articulate that, but I became more detailed, I think. I became more, like, really trying to narrow it down to just the work, not all the other stuff around it, you know?
Yeah.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
It seems like you've gotten the chance to work with some collaborators, like, on a consistent basis. Mm-hmm. Like with Sam Gold with some of the shows you've done.
Oh, yeah.
And Ryan Murphy with some of the TV shows you've done. What has that relationship been like? How does it kind of change the way you get to work as an actor?
You're right. I've been very blessed by that, like, to have a few people that have kind of continued to kind of come back to me for different things. And that is the best. Like, it really is, to be able, because there's so much, I think there's so much, when you first go into a project that you don't know anyone, there's so much ice to break, you know, there's so much of the work is about, like, reading the other person, like, how do you work, how do I work, do I like you, do you like me, there's all that, you know, there's a lot of time and energy that's, like, spent on that at the beginning, and once you can do a second project with someone, that's all just cut through, and you've already kind of created the second language, you know, the double speak, the thing, like, the mm-hmm. you don't even have to talk that much, you know, you kind of just get each other, and that's when it really starts to get interesting, you know, when, like, you can just dive right into the red meat.
Right.
Like, immediately, you know?
And, yeah, you know the ways they like to work and...
Yeah. And they know what you like, and they, you know, I think the rest directors kind of are working their way around the actor in a way, you know? Mm. And so...
That's really interesting, because I feel like both those directors have such a strong style.
They definitely do. I mean, yes.
But that's good to hear that they're also interested in the actor.
Older, an amazingly different, like, wonderful comparisons to make. I'm sure they would both be flattered by it. But Sam does, like, Sam especially is, like, someone who, some actors, I think he talks to a lot, and, you know, really gets in there because he knows that that's what they want, and some actually kind of leaves alone a little bit.
Hmm.
And he will kind of match you. He will kind of match whatever you bring to him. I remember him saying to Sally Field, because Sally was, there was one moment, this isn't speaking off the record, like, there was one moment where in rehearsal for Glass Menagerie that she was pushing back a little bit. She was kind of just testing his vision, because the vision was a bit out there for Glass Menagerie. It was like, we had no set, we had a chair and a big, huge, empty stage. Like, he took the back wall away. Like, it was just the empty Belasco Theater. And I just remember at the beginning of rehearsal, her kind of, like, just needling him a little. Not needling, just, like, questioning every little choice. Why that? Why this? Why that? And he kind of very patiently went through all of her questions. And he said, I am the most patient director that you will ever meet. But, like, I will sit here and do this with you as long as you need me to kind of, basically, without saying it, like, to get you to believe in what I'm doing, like, to get to, like, get you on board. He's like, he's not like he would waver, he wouldn't change his vision, but he will explain he will go to bat with you on every question you have, very kind of methodically and patiently, and, like, just do it, just, like, let's go there. And then there was, like, Joe Mantello, who, like, didn't really have that many questions at all. It just kind of went, it was like, I get it, I do it, let's do it, you know.
Yeah We don't not have to talk about this if you don't want to, but how do you and Sarah, your wife, deal with being in a relationship with two creatives?
How do we that's the thing that's
how do you help each other deal with everything that comes with that?
It's a thing that's an ongoing thing, you know, it's never a thing that's totally figured out. I think we are lucky in that we're not doing the same thing. Like, it's mm-hmm. I think having an actress wife would be even harder than having yeah, you guys have figured out the exception. We've kind of figured out what each of us need, and, like, Like, she, you know, knows when I need some space on my own. You know, like, I think a lot of our learning curve was kind of like me telling her that, like, when I need alone time, it's not that I don't want to be with you. It's just that I need some alone time right now. Like, this is what I need. Yeah. And then when she'd be like, well, I need you to be here right now because I have to work on this thing, so you have to be here. So, you know, it's...
communication is what you're saying.
and compromise, and like, and it is a negotiation. It's negotiation, you know? A lot of marriage is negotiation.
Do you guys...
I'll give you this, you give me that. And that's like, you know, that's okay. Like, it should be. It's not that it's all transactional. It's just like, you know, you give and you get, and it evens out in the end, you know?
Yeah. Do you guys ever get to collaborate on any projects?
Well, we've just actually, in name, actually legally now, have started a production company. I have this horror movie that I've written, horror romance, I like to call it, that our company is a part of producing.
Oh, cool.
So she's been very collaborative, especially, Sarah's an incredible casting director, I think. Casting wasn't such a crazy hard profession, she would be like a genius casting director.
I can see that.
So she's been she's like, she knows everything that's happening, knows everybody somehow. Just, I don't know what she does in there. And so she's been incredibly helpful in that way. And then she's got this doc series that she's trying to get off the ground. So I've been trying to help her a little bit, like a bit on the kind of connection side with that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we find ways to overlap, and you know, but there's also like, you know, there's also like, I need my space right now to do my thing, you know.
Right.
It's like both.
No,
both
of course,
have to exist simultaneously, you know?
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Are there any lessons you've learned over the last couple of years that you're really proud of that you want to share with me?
Oh.
It could be something small or big, whatever you think.
That's a great question. Well, I think one thing I have really thought about is, it relates to the thing I was saying before about auditioning,
mm-hmm.
which is that the part you don't get might be the best thing you ever did. Like, for instance, I auditioned for this, for Tony Kushner in The Intelligent Homosexual.
Right.
And I didn't get it. And I was like despondent about it. And then like a year later, I got a call about this play called The Illusion,
mm-hmm.
At the Signature. And it was like, Tony Kushner kind of wants to see you for this. Could you come and audition? I flew out from LA to it, like totally on my own dime. I slept on friends' couches, the whole thing. And I got that. And then that led to like Nicholas casting me in Death of a Salesman. And that led to so many other things. But that was because I went in at one time and got it and like did an audition and thought it was shitty and didn't get it, and then like didn't work for a while, and then it came back around, you know, that like sometimes the thing that like I guess the point is never to take an opportunity for granted, that like you never know who's in that room, you know.
Yeah.
You really don't. And it could be the assistant working there. Like, that's happened before, too. Like, I was the assistant of what's-his-name. I saw you do that thing. Do you want to do this other thing? Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, that goes far, you know? So
yeah.
Don't discount something. Especially if you think it's, oh, this stupid part that I'm never going to get. Like, still, you never know what it could lead to. Is that any good?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
there are two questions that I usually ask at the end, but is there anything that I didn't touch on that you were really looking forward to talking about?
That's
we
good.
covered a lot of different things.
Yeah, we did. We talked a lot. That's good. You got me talking. I don't usually open up this much. Yeah.
It's a perfect platform for it.
Yeah, really.
So the next question is, like, when you are in a place where you're feeling really down or uninspired, like, are there any concrete things that you reach for again and again? Like a book that you reread or music you listen to or somewhere you go, something like that?
It's funny. You know what's weird is, like, I listen to sad stuff and it makes me feel better. I listen, like, if I just put on Elliott Smith, I'm immediately happier. Like, when I'm in my saddest place, which is the most depressing music imaginable, but he's maybe my favorite artist. I just love Elliott Smith. That's the point.
Maybe it just, like, crystallizes that feeling in some way and you're able to move on.
It does. And he is somehow in that quiet, sad music, I find such joy. There's, like, this weird sense of joy. And really, Elliott Smith, that's my answer.
All right, I love it. And then the last thing is, have you seen anything recently that you want to recommend of any art form?
God, I wish I was in New York. I feel like there's so many great things there to see. But I love the movie, The Favorite. I love the movie Vice. There was this really great documentary Sarah was watching about snowboarding, which sounds bizarre, but it was amazing. Think of it and send it to you. I'm sure there's more. It's hard. I try to inundate myself with so many things, and I can't, like, remember any of the good things.
Oh, we didn't even get to talk about If Beale Street Could Talk. I loved it.
Oh, yeah.
I think I'm going to have Tiana on soon.
Oh, good. She's amazing.
That was so gorgeous.
Thank you.
Oh, my God.
I know. Beale Street is an incredibly filmed thing, it was such a cool... I was only on it for one day, but it was, like, this kind of spiritual experience that, like, Barry Jenkins is, like, this guru, amazing person. So passionate and full of energy. And I got to do the scene with Regina King, and she's now getting so many... knock on wood, like, I think an Oscar is in her future.
She's incredible.
She's getting so many things. And it's cool. I've had this cool thing this year where, despite the fact that these 6 months have been, like, all these movies that fell through, things that I've done, like, a year ago are now coming to fruition. Like, this show, The Assassination of Gianni Versace, this Versace show, mm-hmm. which I've been nominated for a couple things, that's, like, coming at the same time as Beale Street now. So, like, the other day I was at the Golden Globes or whatever, and it was, like, the Beale Street table and the Versace table, like, next door, so I got to, like, be in both worlds, you know?
Yeah, how fun.
That's cool. And, like, you kind of forget when you're hustling and trying to get the things that, like, oh, yeah, I did that thing, and now it's
yeah, because when did you when did you actually shoot those two projects?
A year and a half ago,
yeah.
I shot Versace, and then, like, last October, I shot Beale Street. And so, you know, they'd have their gestational period, and now they, like, come to the world, and then you kind of bear the fruits of that. That's cool, and, like, then it makes you feel like, right, things are happening. It's just, I think that's the lesson, is, like, things are happening, it's going to take longer. You have to have more patience than you ever thought you would. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
They will happen. They just, like, the patience is even more intense than you thought it would be.
And yeah, it's so different with film and TV than with theater, because theater, like, you're involved.
Yes,
it's intimately with every, like, once you start rehearsals, you're involved every day physically. You're involved whenever someone's seeing it, and then to shoot one day on this film a year and a half ago,
I know,
and just now people are seeing it. That's so bizarre.
Yeah, and you and in theater you get immediate feedback. You know, the audience is there. It's responding. You feel how the show is going, for better or for worse.
Yeah.
You know, but you do a movie or you do TV, and movies especially, because that can take. I've done a movie like that took 2.5 years to come out, and you've forgotten what you did by the time it comes out, and so that can either be like a really pleasant surprise, which hopefully it will be. Or like, oh, fuck, what was I doing?
Well, and especially since the director and editor might have chosen things that you wouldn't have chosen, or you wouldn't think they did.
I guess that's the big difference, really, is that, like, you're in theater, although the director has created things beforehand, you're there every moment of decision making. And you're really, you're in someone else's hands in movies. You know, you're like, that's why it's like, that's why actors go crazy. I think that's why actors get become neurotic, like, about choosing their directors and being like, who's directing it? Because, like, they can make or break your performance. You know, the editing is everything.
Right.
And it can make a perform, it can make a good performance great, or it can make a great performance mediocre, you know, or just, or not exist at all, you know, like you're so at the mercy of other people. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that was a tangent basically, because I want to recommend If Beale Street Could Talk.
Yes, please. Me too. I do too. Go watch it. It's really good.
Well, great. Finn, thank you. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
That was awesome. I'm going to turn this off.
Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. If you find these conversations valuable to your life as an artist and would like to support the ongoing production of The Compass, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/thecompasspodcast. Pledges start at as little as $1 a month. You'll get access to bonus content, and anything you can give would be greatly appreciated. Also, if you have a moment, please rate or review in iTunes. Every little bit helps other listeners to find the podcast. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brandon Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.